We don't even need a countdown. We're going raw and live. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Vinay Prasad and Sanjula J. Nagpal, great to have you here. And of course, this is a conversation. This is not a show or a podcast. This is just a conversation. We were in my office chatting and we said, hey, let's just walk out to the chairs and just have this conversation on the cameras so we can be transparent and the glass box that we are.
You know, I've gotten so much positive feedback from these conversations. There is no script. This is all extemporaneous. I don't even know what you're going to ask sometimes and catch me off guard.
I don't know what I'm going to ask.
You don't know either. Okay, so that's good. That makes two of us. But I think people really appreciate these conversations because too often the FDA was completely opaque, that black box, and now we're just having these conversations on camera, talking about whatever we're working on this week and into the future, and letting the American public know directly our thoughts on that.
And there is the FDA with all the scientists busy at work, and it's just been awesome getting to know so many of them. Really impressive people.
Brilliant people. I mean, I have learned, I made a joke that I've learned more in 2 weeks than I learned in 2 years. I mean, you're talking to people all the time who are educating me on topics that I had only scratched the surface on. And you think you know a topic deep, there's depths beyond that. There's oceans beyond that.
Oceans of subspecialization, and it's kind of cool. It's kind of cool. It's an intellectual feast, Sanjula.
That is for sure. I mean, yesterday alone, I mean, I was just thinking on my drive home. I mean, I learned so many things that I thought I knew something about, just a little bit, and completely changed my mind. And I'm excited to talk about some of that today, too.
And the vaccine framework, which has been out now for a day. So we've been absorbing some of the response and feedback to it. And it's been, I think, overall very positive. How would you describe?
I've been inundated with emails, you know, emails, text messages, phone calls from, you know, all of the doctors I trained with at University of Chicago and Northwestern and the National Cancer Institute and OHSU and UCSF, as well as my European colleagues. And I would say the overwhelming majority are telling me, boy, finally a return to a common sense, evidence-based framework. You really struck the perfect balance between making the product available to a huge group of Americans, but also getting the evidence we need. And I think they think we threaded the needle nicely, and we are now no longer a contrarian nation. We're in line with all of Western Europe, which has been doing this for a long time.
The European doctors are like, what took you so long? Yeah,
exactly. My Canadian family members are finally like, great, now we don't have to think about what's different when we come visit you. So
we are no longer an international outlier in regulation of COVID vaccine boosters.
Yeah, but Vinay, I have to commend you. I mean, the way that you presented the framework really struck a great balance of kind of that scientific technical discussion, but also in a way that my grandmother could understand.
Oh, really?
And I think those figures in the paper were really helpful because I've been following both of your work for years, and even for me, a lot of things really connected when I heard, you know, you present it yesterday. It made so much sense. And I am like, wow, how did I not know this before?
Well, I think that's really kind of you to say, and I've actually learned a lot from watching Marty over the years because I think he's been an expert communicator from even before I was in this business. But I think it is something you have to work at, which is that you go from talking to scientists where you speak a certain way to trying to make that more accessible to everybody, which means take out the jargon, substitute, you know, plain words insofar as possible, try to make simple visual images that walk through the core of the problem, you know, as simple as possible, but no simpler, you know, and that's what we were trying to do in that talk.
I mean, to your point about learning every day, right? I mean, even though I'm in this world, I'm less on the clinical side. I didn't know what an endpoint was until yesterday, and I finally understood the difference between surrogate and non-surrogate.
Oh, wow, so that's a big bomb you just dropped there to the world.
I know, but truly, right, the way you explain it, and so a lot of great enthusiasm for the framework. I think a lot of the scientific community is really celebrating, wow, that we're finally following the science. But, you know, I was scanning some of the various headlines and, you know, all of the others, and there's always, you know, there's always going to be critiques and pushback.
In both directions, I'll have you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw some people saying, like, what's wrong with them? They didn't yank all these shots off the market tomorrow.
Yes.
And I saw some people saying, what's wrong with them? They're not giving us a booster every 6 months in perpetuity for the rest of our lives.
Yes.
So, in some ways, all great compromises make extreme positions unhappy. I mean, it's the nature of compromise and pragmatism is that we're aiming for the middle for most Americans, you know, but
yeah. But by my assessment, there's kind of two themes of those comments, right?
Okay.
There's kind of two camps that I think are emerging. One is I would call kind of the blind boosters in perpetuity. So let's call that kind of the blind strategy. And then the other is more of that kind of evidence-based strategy, right? Would you Would you both agree with that?
Yeah, I think we're in the evidence-based camp. I mean, I think the idea that we should recommend a booster for healthy people in perpetuity, that is a young girl born today in her average lifespan will get 80 right. of these COVID boosters, that is a theory, okay? And with hepatitis B, the number ends up being 2 or 3. Right. With HPV, the number ends up being 2 or 3, depending on your age. With MMR, the number ends up being 2 in the United States, 1 in some other countries. And so somebody can make an argument just to keep going with MMR annually for the rest of your life, but there's a general recognition that you sort of optimize your cellular immunity after a certain number. And so there's still a scientific unknown. That is the blind boosters in perpetuity with no clinical trial? Right. And let's be honest, that's what people... Some people are suggesting we do not do any more randomized trials and just keep going forever in infinity with boosters every year.
There's so many problems with the blind boosters and perpetuity strategy, which I guess is a nice way of putting what had been the status quo for a long time. Among those problems is, why only once a year? Why not every 3 months or every 4 months or every 6 months? And why not 18 months? You know, it's also sort of random. And as you point out, there are no clinical trials that guide us. And they really would have us take this young child and throughout the course of their life receive dozens and dozens and dozens of COVID boosters. And we will have absolutely no clue if we make such a person better off. But, you know, here's what really...
That's how dogma is born, by the way.
That's where dogma comes from. And, you know, a lot of the people in that category are people who... don't have the daily task of being a primary care doctor seeing patients. Let me tell you what, one primary care doctor wrote to me and said, you know, you're finally getting how difficult it is to walk into an office. You're sitting across from someone, and I'm a 42-year-old doctor, and there's a 42-year-old patient, and he's a low-risk person, I'm a low-risk person, and the patient tells me, hey, doc, do you think I should get a COVID-19 booster? And I'm like, shucks, I don't even know if I should get one. And truth is, I haven't the last couple of, you know.
I still can't believe he's 42.
Younger, older.
How many peer-reviewed scientific articles have you written?
Something like 540, something like that.
Probably yeah. Don't sleep very
42.
Much.
But you know what? I thought I was working hard until I went to work for this guy. Now I'm working around the clock.
We like to work hard here. They're working hard, so we're going to work hard.
Everyone works hard here. I think that's something I've learned, which is that people truly are working 6 a.m. to late into the evening. I mean, if they're not physically here, they're working on their computers, they are sending emails, they're doing stuff. And it takes your full talents as a doctor and a scientist to try to keep up with people here.
You know, I think everyone signs up to be a doctor or scientist to work hard. I mean, these PhD programs are grueling, they're long, they're hard. Medical school residency, same. And so I think generally that type of person loves hard work. And for me, there's no better heaven than to be surrounded by people who love to work hard while we're here on Earth, by the way. And so that's an exhilarating feeling. But there is tremendous value to being at the bedside and having to explain this to patients. And the Blind Boosters Into Infinity group, that group in America, in healthy people, they are also in denial that there are significant claims of vaccine injury that have not been thoroughly investigated. I can't tell you how many people have told me they just have some residual effects after they got the vaccine, or something happened immediately afterwards and you can't make a direct causal association, but it's suspicious enough that you hear enough of these stories and you think, maybe there was something there. Why else would an otherwise healthy 35-year-old woman suddenly develop a diagnosis immediately after, in the weeks afterwards? So again, you know, we have to use the scientific approach, but there are hundreds of thousands of Americans that say that they have been vaccine injured, and those cases are not being investigated.
Yeah, so I would say that, and now I'm on privy to lots of information that is confidential that we're working through. But I do think that in our group at CBER, we take it extremely seriously. We take these things very, very seriously. And we start with what you talk about, people's anecdotal impressions, what they experienced. And we're tying it to claims data and provider data and our vaccine surveillance system data. And we're trying to look, is there a statistical signal there? And these methods are, you know, work in progress. There's a tried and true part to it, but there's also this sort of the bringing in real world data and expanding our methodology and getting better at these things. And I think we have to be honest that lots of vaccines out there have really good efficacy safety profiles, and we have approved those products, and those are important products. And there are other vaccines where we are still learning more about safety signals, and I think we will better characterize some safety signals into the future. It's a living thing. I mean, vaccine safety and all drug safety. It's not a static thing. It's always kind of a work in progress. You're always learning a little bit more.
It's real time. But now you said something about data that I think it's also worth kind of, we've been having a lot of discussions about how do we improve our data sources to be able to do more real data analyses. And so I just learned this a couple of days ago. Did you know we have about six or seven different adverse reporting data tracking systems?
Oh yeah, each one, their own clunky database, their own clunky website.
And all these crazy funny names.
VAERS.
And then their MOD, like there's a one MOD, that doesn't rhyme with
MOD,
them.
Yeah.
But
the device's data.
Right, but yeah. I come right. from a data world, right? And so we think about, you know, the power of being able to really track a lot of these things come from, we have to be able to connect these systems to see, you know, the way people are reporting it. I didn't know this, you could do it, you know, email, you can send a letter, you can phone call, right? We have all these different inputs that we're getting, and so we have to be able to really put that all together in a way so we can see this stuff at scale and see what's happening in real
time. We're going to do that. I mean, it makes no sense. These giant, clunky databases, you could spend an hour trying to report. You could spend over an hour trying to get data out of it and put a request in. They're not transparent. It's so messy. And the reason that there are so many different clunky adverse event reporting systems at the FDA is that it's been a fiefdom culture. Each of these centers has built their own from scratch.
Yeah.
And we're going to change that. We're creating teamwork, one of the core values of this new FDA. We're going to consolidate, especially in the IT world. We're going to make these user-friendly. And there's no need to have entirely different databases for devices and drugs when you could have one toggle question at the beginning and a user-friendly experience, just like if you use, you know, PayPal or any other app out there.
I think it's a no-brainer. Like, it's a win-win situation. Harmonize these adverse event reporting systems. I mean, to some degree, you know, I'm always appreciative whenever I see a paper from Denmark or Sweden on adverse events, but I'm also kind of pained that why don't we have systems that robust and tied together so neatly that we can't do that in the United States? And I think we are moving in that direction to having that kind of system where we will be the dominating force in characterizing and documenting these events.
I think
I would say it's so frustrating that we're always behind these other countries, right? We're supposed to be the leader in all of this. And so to your point about now we're no longer the outlier on our policy here and now our data systems, we can't do that kind of research. We have to get back on track and get ahead.
We were kind of dug in into the blind boosters into infinity every year without any more clinical trial and randomized data. We were kind of dug in as a government until this new framework that you outlined.
Thanks for that, yeah. And to your point also, I want to just note that in many ways, we are still the best in America. I mean, we're the place of biomedical innovation, the most research, the most research papers, the most publications, the creme de la creme biomedical research, the most innovative companies driving the most innovation. In fact, the globe looks to us for their innovative products, and everyone looks to the FDA. The FDA is in part the FDA of the United States, but so many countries essentially rely on us.
Yeah.
And so I think we are, in so many respects, still the best. But you're right, there are places that we could get even better and bring it all up to the excellent level. And you're right, the blind boosters in perpetuity, it was just taken for granted. So many things in government and bureaucracy and big institutions are just, we used to do it that way, so we're always going to do it that way, without taking a step back and thinking, does that make sense? Is that the best way? Is it evidence-based? Is it common sense-based? And all we're doing is shifting towards that in this space.
And in fairness to the blind burst boosters in perpetuity camp.
The BBPs.
In fairness to that group, they did look to influenza and said, well, we got influenza. But influenza has had over 41 clinical trials.
Yeah.
Influenza has an 80-year track record,
yeah.
Not just one clinical trial from 2020, as COVID did, in certain age groups. And influenza
mutates 24 times faster.
It mutates 24 times faster. Yeah. Bigfoot will tell you that it's got two very flimsy polymerases, which make that hyramidase domain different, even within the same season, at such a higher different. And even with that, we don't hit the mark with the flu shot each year. I'm not disparaging it, but it's an entirely different animal. But I just want to give, because I, you know, I believe in sort of seeing the best in everybody, the blind camp, that is the blind boosters in perpetuity without a clinical trial camp, they would point to influenza and, you know, probably say, well, it works there, so why don't we just adopt that? So I'd like to give a shout out to people with a different point of view.
Yeah, and I think maybe to give them a little bit more, like, to steel man that a little bit more, like, why I could see how they could have adopted it. You know, the world was different in 2021. We had debuted a vaccine program, and then we started to vaccinate people, and we were very optimistic. A lot of people were optimistic that the vaccines would completely halt transmission. You remember a lot of people got on TV and said that they knew that to be true, which I think was a bridge too far, but a lot of people were optimistic. Then by the summer of 2021, we were getting breakthrough infections, and by the fall of 2021, we had Omicron variants, and we had complete vaccine breakthrough, at least for symptomatic disease. Perhaps it had still protection for severe disease. So I can see why in that environment, somebody would say, boy, all we need is one more dose or one more dose. Remember, they used to say, I always told you it was a 3-dose series. I always told you it was a 4-dose series. Right. I always told you it was a 5-dose series. Right. You know, so I can understand why that ball could have started, that snowball could have started. But we have an obligation, all of us here at FDA, to follow the best available science and to pick up questions, you know, as we get them.
What percent, are you going to say something?
No.
What percent of the public do you think believes in the blind boosters in perpetuity strategy without any clinical trial evidence moving forward?
I think it has to be lower than the percent of the public that participates in such a strategy, which is already low. You know, like you're pointing out, one study showed 85% of healthcare workers didn't get the COVID booster themselves. And among the people who got it, some of those people want data, right? So it's going to be a fraction of those people. So, I mean, I think...
So in healthcare, it might be 15% believe in that blind boosters in perpetuity without any further clinical
trial. Probably some of those 15%, they want data. Like, they're grateful for us to having data. They just did it because
they felt
caught up in it. But the vast majority of doctors, I think, are where we are. I also believe, my belief is the media on issues...
How about media writers? What percent believe in the blind boosters?
Extremely high, maybe. And the reason I feel that is... You know, they've been throughout the pandemic, they're like, oh, what percent of you still wipe down your packages? And among regular Americans, it's very low, but among people who work at these Eastern and West Coast media outlets, it's through the roof.
I saw that study.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, wipe down your packages or still wear an N95 on the subway, and you know, all these kinds of things. We have to admit that the people writing for these outlets, they don't represent the average American. They never have. At least not in recent years. They've drifted further away, and that's led to problems in all sorts of spaces, but especially in the medical science space, and especially on COVID-19 policy.
I mean, I would also add, though, just to everyone's credit, you know, the pandemic was this rare thing, right? It was a moment of people were scared, didn't know, a lot of uncertainty, to your point, and now there's new data and evidence. But at what point over the last 4 or 5 years were we mass explaining and educating the American public of what was changing, right? We're starting to do that now, and, you know, there's a sub-community that was really in tune with the science, and we're following experts like the two of you along the way, but that wasn't what was being shared on national media necessarily all the time, right? So how could someone necessarily know that these things have changed when we weren't really telling them, and now we are trying to explain that?
I mean, I guess the elephant in the room is that, of course, Marty and Jay Bhattacharya and many others who now hold very important institutional positions, we're always on these issues ahead of the curve and probably much more in sync with the average American. And for that reason, I think the public, you can see on every social media platform I follow, was really extremely pleased with these selections. I mean, I was too. I know them personally to be excellent scientists and doctors, but also to be the kind of people who are willing to at times push against groupthink, I think is a very admirable trait. And what we're doing here is sort of bringing that philosophy to the FDA. We're changing the prior precedent a little bit, moving in this evidence-based common sense direction, bringing the US in line with, you know, the rest of the world, who always thought us to be an outlier. And I think that's what people want, and people are happy to have that. That's what my email inbox is telling me.
Yeah. Data is so key, and I think, you know, we're talking about a lot of hard data here. I also come from a world where we did a lot of kind of qualitative data and getting, you know, input from surveys and, you know, direct people from the market. As Marty knows, I used to, you know, run a lot of CEO groups to understand, you know, what are they thinking, what are their priorities. And so that's a big part of our mission here at the FDA.
I've really, by the way, enjoyed talking to CEOs of different companies. I've met with some trade associations where they bring CEOs. And look, you were saying, like, you know, Marty's good at explaining. So I think talking is a skill set you can learn. The hard skill set, which I've not mastered, but it's something I value highly, is listening and evolving your position and showing humility. And you know what? Maybe I was wrong about this and saying that openly and publicly. I find just the oration part is something that can be highly scripted. But listening is a hard job, and it takes patience because you have to let somebody run around the barn with all their stories and explanations and things that they are trying to, and everyone's got something to push on the FDA. Everyone's got business in front of the FDA. A lot of people think they have the cure for whatever, and they really want the FDA to expedite. Listen, actually taking the time to listen and not sort of shutting down that idea, that's, I think, the hard skill set. But do you have plans to that end?
What are we going to do, Marty?
Well, I was thrown this idea by Sanjula earlier this morning about maybe we should think about some kind of listening tour to meet with executives from the industry and just do it on a sort of a big scale. Maybe
we'll go West Coast, East Coast.
West Coast, East Coast, my old stomping ground.
Middle of the country, maybe, too.
Yeah, the bi-coastal elite is, is, you know, sucking up all the bandwidth.
Leave that to the reporters, not to go to the middle of the country.
I mean, maybe we pick some cities. I think the San Francisco Bay Area, where you come from.
The hub of innovation. I mean, there's a lot of companies in that area.
But companies of all stages and sizes, which I think is going to be really important, right? We tend to talk a lot about just the established players, but there's a lot of innovation and, you know, new entrants coming to market too.
And we'll go listen, get people's ideas, feedback, what they're excited about, think about those products and how we can expedite them safely and you know, to market.
Maybe do like a town hall style meeting with executives from leaders, R&D, CEOs of industry. Next week is crazy for me, but the following week, maybe towards the end of the week, we hit San Francisco.
I'll have to clear it with my boss.
you're cleared. The San Francisco Bay Area, you got to clear it with Bigfoot. Bigfoot, is that okay with you? If we make a national tour?
Yep.
National town hall listening tour? Bigfoot's on board.
Okay.
And San Francisco Bay Area, I think, would be good. San Diego, a lot of companies in San Diego.
Boston
would be great.
What about Texas?
Dallas, I think. Yeah. I think Dallas and Houston.
New York, maybe?
New York would be good, yeah.
And right
Atlanta.
Here in Washington, D.C.? Atlanta, okay.
Yeah, we should do some maybe
Something here.
Do one or two here. I mean, at some point we got to work, so we can't just be doing town halls all the time. But it'd be good
to get all these themes and see if there are any common themes and sentiments across all these different conversations.
And just ask, what do you think the FDA should be doing that it's not doing?
Right.
I mean, I love great ideas. And sometimes people attribute the ideas to me, and I say, no, these are ideas of the scientists here. When we get them alone without their boss and say, what have you always wanted to do here that you've never been able to do? And they talk. I mean, they will start talking. They have the confidence of anonymity and not being...
And they'll act upon their suggestions if feasible and practical and make sense.
They can help implement these ideas. There's some big ideas in the pipeline.
Good.
Big ideas coming
down. I like
down.
This because I know you get bombarded with requests to meet with all these different companies all the time. You can't spend all your day just doing that, right?
It's hard because I want to, and I love meeting people.
Right. So this is a good way to bring a bigger group together and open it up to anyone who wants to share those ideas.
Yeah, I think people have come into this job, and this is not a criticism of anyone, but I think it's easy to come into this job and meet with all these external stakeholders. But I like meeting with both external stakeholders and the scientists here, getting them, one-on-one and having them explain what can we do big, meaningful, common sense that bridges our two giant themes, and that is gold standard science and common sense both.
Hey, I'm curious, since you started the job, what's been the most surprising thing for you about this job?
I mean, I would say I'd say a couple things. I would say the incredible expertise and ideas that live here within the FDA. Two, how hard it has been to post things on Twitter.
Because there's a huge clearance process.
I don't know. Even getting my login took like a month or something.
I see.
Piece of that is you're sharing a lot of your own communication, which I think is also a new precedent.
A new precedent, yeah. And I'm sure these kind of videos. And we did the one we did was live in a way. The virtue of live is that no attorney can go and redact what you're saying. I mean, it's just right out there.
By the way, I did invite a couple reporters who had asked for interviews. Okay. I invited them to do the interview right here.
And live stream it.
Live stream on our cameras.
Wonderful.
And two of them, and they both declined.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. I don't know. But one of them did say if they could come and watch the conversation. I don't want to call it a podcast. And then have a one-on-one interview, not with cameras, afterwards.
Edited for clarity.
Well, edited for clarity.
You know, I want to say, this is my push to the reporters. You know, if you cover regulatory policy, if you cover the FDA, and if you have covered all our major decisions, including the decision this week, come here, pull up a chair, ask the questions, live stream it. I think that's good for the American people. We won't know your questions, you know. We don't even know each other's questions, to be honest with you.
We literally
don't have time to prepare for this. But it will be really good. Ask the question exactly what you're thinking about this policy, and we'll answer it off the cuff. And I do think the absolute raw video feed is what people want. I think you see that across all social media platforms. You see people craving three-hour podcast discussions, people listening to 3 to 4 hours where there are no edits. I think the editing is a problem because it's selective editing, selective quotes. They frame it a certain way. It's supposed to be neutral, but it's really sort of the opinions of the author. And if you follow the same reporter, you can see some have some opinions, others have other opinions. That's why I think this is the fairest forum. Yeah. Pull up a chair.
Yeah, not even the opinions of the author sometimes. I know great reporters who submit things and I'll say, that's kind of a funny, you know, headline that, you know, yeah, that was on your piece, which was a good piece.
Oh, the headline, right. Written by somebody else. That's an editor.
By the higher-ups in corporate media. So, no, the reporters are great. They're helping getting the message out there. Yeah. We love them. I believe in love thy neighbor. And
okay,
so
good.
They're doing a good job in communicating what's happening at the FDA. In general, of course, you know, it's not a homogeneous group. But I think the more conversations, the better, and the more dialogue, the better, and the more we can be transparent and open and just run this unedited, the better. Of course, the downside of an unedited conversation on video is there's going to be boring parts and we're going to trip up a little bit.
Yeah.
But you know that I think it's better just put it all out there.
Yeah.
So we interrupted you. So you said. The people here were impressed.
The things that surprised you about FDA
posting on X
being so difficult for your Twitter account.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not going to let me out of this question, are you?
No.
I mean, there's a lot of things. I think that one thing that surprised me is how you can actually do stuff. I anticipated just this calcified bureaucracy where to do anything you have to go through this giant rulemaking process, and there's a statute for everything that has some clause that somebody's going to interpret to say you can't do this, but you can actually do big stuff. And we are seeing so many geniuses say they want to come work at the FDA, and that's always been the case. People have always wanted to come and work here, but I'm seeing it from the front lines. People coming, and they're talking to folks, and the word is getting to me that. You know, there's this amazing person and scientist and academic and person with experience in every area of healthcare that wants to come here. I mean, you're both examples of that. And we've got a diverse group of people with incredible backgrounds. We're going to put together a couple dream teams that'll be kind of a SWAT team to work on very specific issues. And we are hiring. Look, the FDA is hiring. We're not doing a massive reorg at this point. We are hiring scientific reviewers. We're hiring scientists that can help us achieve our goals of delivering more cures and meaningful treatments for the American public and healthier food for children. And so that is going extremely well. We are going to be talking about talc at some time very soon. Amazing topic. I've learned a lot about it. But we're just going to keep going, just as we did with the petroleum-based food dye removal, with all of these initiatives. And I think it's an exciting time.
So exciting.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. Good to see you. And we'll have more of these conversations if you like them. Hopefully you do. So far, the feedback has been good. We just got to keep it tight so we can go right back to the office and get work done. This has been playing a little bit here, but work at the same time. Work
you were play. Just in my office earlier this morning. I'm like, why don't we just, you know,
why don't we just walk
on
over and have this, this conversation without, you know.
I have to walk all the way down from there, so I got to come
get
the far
your steps
way.
In.
Yeah, get my steps in.
You get the cafeteria, and on Tuesday is the farmer's market on your way.
Yeah. So great.
Yeah.
Good to see you.
All right. Good to see you guys.
All right. Yeah.